Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein, and this week we have with us a really interesting show, and I want to put a disclaimer on it. The show is certainly not for everybody. We will be speaking about matters of faith and betachim, and it is a consensus of the Gedolim of many generations, well, not all, but many, that certainly somebody who is a maimon, who is a believer because he accepted it from his parents, from his grandparents, and he believes in faith, there is no reason to be chaykir and dairish, to question, to ask, to study other proofs of God. So for many of the listenership here who go to yeshiva, who come wonderfully from families and have never been bothered by these questions, I ask you, please turn off your radio now. There are, however, people who do have questions. We live in a secular world. You know, we read newspapers. We use MRI machines and phones, iPhones, the internet, etc. So we know science works. We go to doctors when we're sick, and we use all kinds of penicillin, etc. And when science says hurtful things about religion that seem to imply that we are pagan and we're, you know, the Neanderthal man, you know, here are some of the famous quotes you've heard, and maybe in your lifetime, you see them in the paper. When one person suffers from delusion, it's called insanity. When many people, it's called religion. That's from Dawkins. Right? Or what can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. Or here's one of the quotes. Faith is the surrender of the mind, the surrender of reason. Or science is the new God. So rather than be fearful and flee, I said, let's address it head on. We just said in Pesach, we said, by the Russia, Hake es Shinov, which when I was a child, I thought meant to be knock out his teeth. I once saw Haggadah, where it's a father punching the Russia in the mouth. But it's a mistake, because Hake is with the letter Kuf, not with a Chaf. With a Chaf, it means to strike. With Kuf, it means something else. It means to dull or blunt. The Russia has a bite. He has questions. Well, let's take away the bite. Let's blunt the edge of the knife so that it can't cut anymore. Now, the Gemara in Saita says, Tchilas nefila nis, I think it's on Daf Mem Beis. The beginning of defeat is fleeing. I remember I had a story when I lived in Lakewood where you know, there was a knock on the door, and one of my brothers all went to the door, and there was a big slam. I said, what was that? He said, it was one of the missionaries. They came to talk, and I chased them out. I said, no. Oh, I went to the door. I invited him in. I sat them down by the table, and he took. I said, you know, tell me, what do you got? He takes out his English Tanakh. It says, and he was pierced. I said, it doesn't say he was pierced. You don't speak Hebrew, do you? I said, you're reading the verbiage wrong. The next proof, after the fourth one, all of which were incorrect, he looks at his friend, they look at their watch, they say, you know, we better leave now. And they ran out because we have nothing to fear. You know, all about Klal Yisrael is about history. You know, Me'ovei Techachmeni, when Ben-Gurion was asked by the OU, by the UN, to present his case for the State of Israel, he got up and he said, look at us. He says, the pilgrims landed in the 1600s. What month did they land? What day did they land? What did they eat on their ship? What did they eat on Thanksgiving? Every Jewish child, he said, knows we left Egypt the 15th of Nisan. The bread that we ate was matzah. The meat that we ate was the Paschal lamb. We have such a beautiful history. Why should we be afraid of people who come, of newcomers who come, and say there is no makor for your faith and science has displaced it? So let's look at science with some of the greatest scientists in the world and ask them questions and really be surprised at the answers and how there's actually proof from science that there is a kaviyachol, that there is a bairi elam. I want to preface this by saying another thing, that there is uncertainties in the Rishonim. The Chayvus Halvavus in Shar HaBechina, right, says very clearly that one is actually mechuyev to discover and search. Da esali kayavicha. Notwithstanding that, you know, if you look at the Pirush on the bottom, he brings those who disagreed with the Chayvus Halvavus in the Minchas, in the Sefer Achinuch and the Agdama, Devar Yamaschal V'Ata. He seems to imply that we shouldn't, even though in Mitzvah Chafei, Emunas Hashem, he says clearly that it's a higher level. So I will say that the Chayvus Halvavus clearly says there's an obligation. The Rambam seems to imply so. But I'm not doing it based on that. I'm saying, I think even the chinuch, and I heard this from Rashi of Toronto, he said, even the chinuch would be maida, that somebody who has been struck by these doubts and questions, in that case, is obligated to look for answers. So I think on this show, we will provide you with definitive proofs. Now, I want to make a preface. There are different types of proofs, both in halacha and in law. For example, in Dine Mominis, it's Lefi Eine HaDayin. What the Dayin seems to feel is right. When it comes to Dine Nefashos, there's a different level of proof. You need a Bezdin of either Chav Gimel or Ayin Aleph. You need close to unanimity, right? That's the second level of proof. The third level of proof is Yediyah, is actual knowledge. I was an eyewitness, right? Clearly, we will never be an eyewitness. Absolute proof is never, that's why it's called emunah. But let's try to see what level, after this program, you could say, you know, you raised my level of emunah. And in American law, it's the same thing. There's something called, in civil law, preponderance of the evidence. For example, you're sitting in a room, somebody walks in with a wet umbrella. Well, can you say with definity that it's raining outside? Could be he had his umbrella in a plastic bag. He left it here last time he was here. And he said, oh, I'm going to pick it up. And he took it out of the umbrella and it's wet. It could be he stuck it in the sink for some strange reason. If it was a litigation of money, you could use that assumption and say, yes, that's enough evidence for me to obligate the person. It's called preponderance of the evidence. In criminal matters, there's something called beyond a reasonable doubt. Right? So if you'd be sitting in the room with the wet, and then another man walked in with a wet raincoat, and a third fellow, this happened a few times, you say, look, this doesn't make sense already. Right? Five things in a row don't happen. He didn't have his thing in there. Now, and then there's obviously eyewitness. I believe from science, we can actually prove that there's a Borei Olam, and I say we could do it to the level where it's beyond a reasonable doubt. Let me tell you the four, we will do this in four programs, but this is how we will go about it. We will start with the question that Rabbi Bachya ibn Pakuda, we will ask this to all the scientists on the show, asked almost, I don't know, just around 1,000 years ago. He writes in Chalvavos, again in Shar Gimel. He says, I want to know, did God create the world or did the world create itself? Which was the sheet of Aristotle, Cadmus Ilum. And by the way, science, here's something astonishing. Do you know that science, until 1964, believed in the steady state universe, which means the universe had been here forever and it was never created? That's until 1964, something astonishing. And which is obviously against the whole concept of a Borei Olam, which we believe that there was a creator. And what happened was in 1964, what established it was two scientists at Bell Laboratories, right here in New Jersey, right across the bridge, right, were doing a study for microwave technology. They had these huge antennas, and they were trying to get a perfectly clear sound. And whichever part of the world, of the universe, they pointed the antennas at, they heard static. And they pointed one direction, the other, and they cleaned the antennas. They thought maybe it was pigeon droppings. And they discovered they were hearing noise. It was an echo. And they realized they were hearing the echo of creation, of Bria Salem, what they call the Big Bang, which we'll speak about shortly. And they won a Nobel Prize. So until 1964, and the great scientist Francis Collins, we hope to have him on the show, he's the greatest scientist in America, he writes over there, he says, the great astrophysicist Davy said, he said it's the equivalent, and I'm paraphrasing it because I don't have it in front of me, it's the equivalent of scientists scaling this huge mountain, the peak of knowledge, arriving at the top and finding a bunch of ancient rabbis sitting there. Because we had always believed in a Bria, and in 1964 they discovered solid state wasn't true. So the Chaim Soloveitchik writes in Shaar Gimel, we will ask this to our eminent scientist, he says, if the world created itself as they believed until 64, it could only create itself in one of two ways. Either it created itself before it existed, or it created itself after it existed. Both of which make no sense. How do you create yourself before you exist? And if you already exist, why create yourself? He said, can you explain it? And he goes, that's one of his first proofs. So we will ask whether science has any explanation 1,000 years to agreed the world we all agree came from a beginning now. What instigated the beginning? What precipitated the beginning? Where did the beginning come from? Nothing. Something does not come from nothing. We will ask this as a scientist. That will be one of the routes we go. And the other route we go is we will be speaking about the Big Bang. Now, for those of you who are not aware, and there are Rishonim who disagree, but the Ramban in the beginning of Bereshis speaks about the Big Bang very clearly. And the Ramban says that all of creation, as we happened, came from a tiny nekuda, right? He says like this, the Ramban in Pasuk Aleph in Bereshis, he says, Haitzi mina efes hagomer, created from the absolute efes hagomer, there's no way to say it, from nihilo, they say that, from zero, from hamuchlet, the absence of anything, yisoidak, a tiny piece of matter, ma'oid, dak ma'oid, a dot, aim by mamish, and that dot, hu koichi mamtzi muchan lekabal tzura, v'hu hachaymer harishayin. Right? He says, and after that bang, loy bradover, he didn't create anything new, but yatsar, he just formed, yatsar v'asa, mimenu himtzi hakoil, v'hilbish hatsurais v'tikan oisam. Ramban says, and he says it again later on, he says, what's the size of that dak? Shehi nekuda ktana daka, it's a tiny dot, ein b'mamish, it was ethereal, it had nothing to it. And if you look in the Medrash, says in Tanchuma, in Parshas Tzav, Pasuk Yud Beis, it says, Hashamayim ke'elu, he says, they were the size of the black of the eye. He says, when God created heaven and earth, it came from the pupil of the eye that was the size. The Gemara says, when it describes the bang, the olam was nispashet and nispashet ad sh'amar lo lamay dai. It was spreading until he said, stop, that's the amount. We'll speak about that soon. When the scientists reached this mountain, to quote Collins, and they found the theologians, the rabbis sitting there who were saying, yes, it came from a beginning. So there's a lot of problems. Scientists, physicists said, okay, there was a Big Bang. And in the Big Bang, they say there were many factors to making it successful. And I will mention three of them, and we will hear them. We will discuss this with them as well. There are 17 constants that for the Big Bang to be successful. And here's the first one. It's called the flatness problem. And what is the flatness problem? You know that when a rocket ship takes off, if it goes too fast, it breaks the atmosphere too fast. There's no friction in space. It just, zoom, takes off, will go forever. Just like as the Voyager. It's passing Mars now, or Pluto, or whatever, whichever planet it's passing. We're getting sending great big. It doesn't need any energy. It just flies. If it takes off too slowly, it will come back to Earth. It won't break the atmosphere. There's something called release speed, where it breaks the atmosphere and then goes into orbit. Yet it's pulled back, so that way it shows pictures around the Earth forever, just flying orbit forever. At the time of the Big Bang, there was also a science to it. If it would have been too fast, it would have been nispashet until it was dust. We would have been the big dust. There would be no planets. It just was shoom to forever with the great force. Would have been too slowly. It would have been the great crunch. Would have the gravity of that matter would have pulled everything back together, and it would have been would have fallen back. So there was an exact speed to send a world, a universe, into where it's going at the correct speed. And what is that? So there's differences among scientists. We're going to go with Paul Davies. It's 10 to the 55th power. It's 10 with 55 zeros on it. You know, to give you an example of what 10 with 55 zeros on it is, and you can Google these numbers, all the leaves, and what's the point? If it would have been 10 to the 54th power, if it would have been shorter by 100th, or maybe by 1,000, three zeros, we would have crunched in too much gravity. 58 zeros, boom, too much strength, dust. So it had to be really finely tuned. You know, finely tuned 10 to the 55 power. Science says this happened at random because they don't believe in a Byrium. They don't believe in a crater and a creator. All the sand on the planet Earth, all the sand is 10 with 22 zeros after it. So it's like saying to somebody randomly, go pick. You have all the continents, North America, South America, Antarctica, I don't know if there's ice there, Europe, you have Asia, Africa. Pick a grain of sand on a beach. If you pick the right one, we survived. If you didn't, we're dust. That's 10 to the 22nd power. This is 10 to the 55th power. We're going to hear about the strong nuclear force, the force that allows the nucleus of the atom to hold together, the proton and the neutron, is 10 with 36 zeros. That's how much stronger it is than gravity. Less than that, on great gravitational planets, like on great, you know, Earth, for example, on Jupiter, the gravity is 300 times our mass, so the gravity is 300 times greater. If it wasn't exact, where you have greater gravitational force, atoms would start discombobulating and falling apart. It's very exact, 10 to the 36th. It would be stronger, right? Many planets wouldn't be able to survive. Their own gravity would suck them in. This is what the astrophysicists say. Greater. And again, it would prevent nuclear fission. Our sun would not be able to warm us because it runs off of nuclear fission. To give you an example of the randomness that is 10 to the 36th, let's pick another thing. All the leaves on Earth and all the blades of grass are 10 to the 19th power. So it's go pick a blade of grass someplace on the planet. If you're lucky, if you randomly pick the right one, we survive. And if not, we don't. Here's another one. It's called the cosmological constant. Post-Big Bang, and it was a long time ago. And I say that time here really, it's hard to describe time. When Rabbeinu Shlomo talks about Maisa Bereishis, and we talk about Bereishis Yom Echad, when there's no planet, there's no sun. So time has a different meaning. It comes space-time, right? So post the Big Bang, they say that there's dark energy that acts as the barrier between gravity and the expansion. It's called the cosmological constant. Its energy compared to gravity is 10 to the minus 123rd power. And that is the exact number Einstein wrote that it has to be. These are 3 of 17 constants. You know how much 10 to the minus 123rd power is? That's the random number that balances the existence of space today. It's the equivalent of telling you, your neighbor walking in and saying, I won the national Powerball. The national Powerball is you have 1 in 292 million chance of winning it. Basically almost 1 in 300 million. So the guy says he won it, you would say, wow. First you would ask him if he has a daughter who's available. But then you would say, wow, that's the most incredible number. Now he said, but I have news for you. I didn't win it one time. I won it for 17 days in a row. I won the national lottery. Right? I mean, it's beyond bizarre. I won 1 to 292 million, but I won it 17 days in a row. That's what 10 with 123 zeros is. Now, somebody walks in and they say, these are 3 of the reasons why the random chances that I happen to be here today. What would you say to this person? They just give me 55% odds in the stock market, I'm happy. 5%. You're talking billions and trillions combined many times over. So we will speak to the scientists. How could the Big Bang, how could this fashion happen randomly? Then we will speak to a different group of scientists, and they will speak about something called rare earth theory. In the galaxy, in the universe, what are the odds the Earth has 200 constants that allows the Earth to be the right place for life to exist? We haven't found it anywhere else, like Fermi said. Tens of thousands, millions of inhabited planets, well, why haven't they contacted us? So we're going to speak to the scientists who wrote the rare Earth hypothesis, saying the incredible coincidence, remarkably rare coincidence, that Earth is able to have life. And then last, we're going to speak to one of the great macrobiologists of the world. He wrote Michael Behe. He wrote a book that was said one of the top, most important books of the 100 most important books of the last century. And he will speak about what are the odds of through Darwinism that we have actually life on this planet, that it could have evolved the way Darwin said. For example, Paul Davy says, there is 200,000 proteins in the human body. Each protein happening randomly is the equivalent of giving a blind person a Rubik's Cube and telling him to do it. He said he could turn it every second his entire life. A blind person would not end up doing a Rubik's Cube. Now put 200,000 people in a room and ask them, you have to do all 200,000 proteins together simultaneously. These are the odds. So can we say, after listening to these scientists, well, you know, I've proven it. Well, that's why it's called Emunat Kin. But can we look in science and say, wow, to believe in all these incredibly long odds coming in, I mean, not long odds, I mean, just incredibly crazy. You picked the right leaf of grass on the world, and you picked up the right sand, the same guy, and you also missed you're the lucky guy who won the lotto, the Big Bang lottery, 17 days in a row with 15 or 20 other hypotheses, and you look at it and you say, you know what, it's just, I think I have beyond a reasonable doubt. So again, this program is not for the person who is the Maimon, who has it from his avos, who knows that we know they ate matzo when they left, and what day they left, and what food they ate, they ate mara. It's not for you. But if you're the person who says, you know, I go to MRIs and listening to all this stuff, you know, the God delusion, God is dead, and we can thankfully say Hitchens is dead and God is alive. I want to know, this is to you who this show is, and these next few series of shows are. So ask your Rav before you do it. I do not want to get involved in the machloikis. What does the chinuch mean? I do not want to get in the shayla of kvoid alekim, hafter davar, kvoid malachim, chakor davar, the two pshitas in the Yerushalmi. Does it start at Maisabishis, or does it start after Brias Adam? Here we will be going with the sheet of the Chayvus Halvavus and the Rambam and the Chinuch and Mitzvah Chafei. And anybody else, please do not listen from here on in. Read at this word from our sponsor. Headlines 2 is now out. It came out before Pesach, and it sold out. The OU, the Menucha, they called me up. We did a second printing. It's now in Yesfarim stores. Go get it. It's going to be the best halacha sefer your family is going to buy this year. Here's a letter from a lady, Mrs. Siegel, in Borough Park. I bought it as a gift for Yom Tov for my husband. What a mistake. He didn't put it down. He talked about it during the tables with our children. I've never seen him learn a halacha sefer before. Thank you so much. I encourage all of you, go out. You'll have what to talk about with your children. They're going to say, wow, Abba, Mommy, they became so cool. They know everything. What's going on? I think it's a fantastic gift, and it's something that you will enjoy. Here's a disclaimer. Before we begin to our guests, and these are all secular scientists, we are not advocating affirming their positions on any hashkafas. We're just listening to them to hear the remarkable set of mathematical coincidences of what it takes to be here, to be alive on the world today. So again, we're using them for their scientific knowledge, not for their hashkafas. Let's go to our guests. And before I get him on the radio, I want to say his name is, we have two guests tonight. We have Lord Sir Martin Rees. He's the Astronomer Royal, Master of Trinity College, the most decorated scientist in England. I'm not bringing schlock over here. He's the president of the Royal Society. He's the Oxford Heinemann Award for astrophysicists. He won the gold medal of the Royal Astronomical Society. He won the Bauer Award, the Balzer Award, the Albert Einstein World Award for Science. He's won the Order of Merit. Too many awards to say. We'll have him on. And we will also have on one of the gentlemen, Professor Dr. John Leslie of the Royal Society of Canada. He's the professor at the Gould University. And he wrote Universes, where he lists many of these remarkable, bizarre coincidences. So we really, this show we will have two eminent scientists. The next show we will bring on others. Let's go to our guests. We have the honor of having with us on the phone the Right Honorable Lord Rees of Ludlow, otherwise known as Professor Martin Rees, who is probably the most famous scientist in England. And he has too many awards. If I read all the awards he won, it would take up the entire time of this show. So suffice to say, it's a great honor to have with you. Welcome, Professor Rees.
Very glad to be on your show.
So, Professor Rees, your book, Six Numbers, which has really achieved such a following here in the United States, I know this is going to be elementary for you, but most of our listener base is lay people who do not have doctorates in either astronomy, physics, but could you walk us through the concept of the six numbers and explain them to us, to lay people?
Yes, I'm glad to do this. And we understand, of course, that the universe is very complicated, nature is very complicated, but it is governed by some underlying principles. All material is made up of atoms and particles, and the forces of nature, the forces of electricity, magnetism, and gravity are very important, and it's the strength of those forces and other properties of the universe which determine the way things are. And in my book, Just Six Numbers, I tried to isolate six numbers which represented the most important features of our natural world, about why life could evolve, why the universe could exist and be stable and exist for a long time, etc. And I tried to isolate these numbers and see what would happen if they were different. And the main conclusion of my work was that some important features of the universe are very sensitive to what these numbers actually are, in that if you imagine tuning the knobs to make a universe with different numbers, it would be a universe very different from ours and where perhaps no life could exist. So my main point was to try and see how special our universe was and imagine what universe would be like if the numbers were different.
So can you give us an example that our listenership would understand?
Yes. The force of gravity, for instance, which is the force that holds us to the ground, makes apples fall, and holds the moon in orbit around the Earth, and holds the Earth in orbit around the Sun. This is a crucial force, of course. But if that force was very strong, stronger than it is, then we would find that gravity would actually crush us. We couldn't exist. So gravity has to exist, but it has to be a weak force so that it's able to hold the planets in orbit, but not so strong that it would crush us and make us be squeezed on the ground, as it were. That's one example.
Okay. Can you give us an example of some of those that are sort of head-scratching, like the odds of just landing on the likelihood, are rather remote?
Well, there is another important number in the universe, which is important if we think of the larger scales of the universe, if we think of the scale of galaxies. And here there is a force which is pushing the universe apart to make it expand. And this force is not very well understood. It's a force which is latent in space, which pushes things apart and makes the expanding universe accelerate. And this is very, very weak. And if that was stronger, then the universe would move apart so fast that there'd be no chance of any galaxies or stars forming at all. And this is thought by many physicists to be a very surprising bit of fine-tuning, because most of them would have expected that this force would be much stronger than it actually is in our universe. And so this is quoted by many physicists as the most extreme case of fine-tuning.
And what would that number be, Doctor?
Well, I mean, some people think that the best guess at the strength of that number would be stronger than the actual strength of this force by a number with 100 zeros in it, a really big number.
Professor, could you try to explain to us a number with 100 zeros? What does that mean? Like, I know, I understand what it means to make $1 million or to lose $100.
Yes, yes, yes.
What does it explain? What is 100? Give us some type of a metaphor for what 100 zeros means.
Well, I mean, that would be a bigger number than the total number of atoms in the universe.
Wow.
A very big number indeed. So even if the universe was made of ink, you couldn't write it down.
Wow. Could you give us, Professor, another number that you would say shows to fine-tuning? Another metaphor, another example.
Well, there's another number which is important to cosmologists. It's not anything you can observe on the Earth, but it's a number which tells us about how the universe evolved and how galaxies and stars formed, because the universe started off as a very hot, dense entity, and it expanded and cooled, and the galaxies formed from initial irregularities in it. And if this important number, which I call Q, were very large, then the universe would just consist of black holes and nothing else. If this number was too small, then it would still consist just of hydrogen and nothing else. No stars or galaxies would have formed. So the universe has to have a certain texture in order for structure to form. And this, again, is encapsulated by a number which I call Q, and this number has to be not too big and not too small.
And what would that number look like? Like you said, you had one number with 100 zeros. What would this one look like?
Well, this is not so finely tuned.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Professor, what I took away from your book is the concept of it seemed inevitable, like something with 100 zeros, you say all the ink in the universe couldn't write that. Then
yes.
There is a designer to the universe. So let me ask you a question.
Mm.
There was a medieval philosopher. His name was Bahya ibn Pakuda.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book around 1,000 years ago, and he posited the following question. And he was struggling with where does the universe come from. He asked, if the universe created itself, it could only have created itself in one of two ways. It either created itself after it existed, or it created itself before it existed.
Mm-hmm.
He said, both of which make no sense.
Mm-hmm.
So you would say where the Big Bang came from is still a mystery?
It is still a mystery, yes. Mm. And also whether our Big Bang was the only one, that's another mystery.
Right. So let me ask you, Doctor, when I read your book and I looked at it and I said, wow, you know, 100 zeros, you go through lambda, you go through the smoothness problem, the flatness problem, and you add all these up together. How does scientists, and I think 60% of scientists do not believe in intelligent design, how do they respond to the unlikeliness of our being here, you know, 10 with 100 zeros following? How do they respond to that?
Well, I mean, I think in two ways. One possibility is that there are huge numbers of Big Bangs, and most of them are not hospitable for life, and we naturally find ourselves in the one which is tuned so that it does allow life. And just as, you know, if there's a lottery, then however many tickets there are, someone's going to win. And in the same way, however, if there are many Big Bangs, then one is going to be one in which life could exist. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that perhaps there will be some explanation as to why the numbers are tuned in this way. So it will then look natural and not surprising. So those are two options, I think.
So, Doctor, the first option, I believe they call the multiverse, that there are an infinite number of universes and, you know, in infinity things happen.
Well, it may be infinite or it may be just a huge number. We don't know.
So, Doctor, I would like to ask you a question. Imagine you were sitting on a jury.
Yes.
And a man was accused of killing his wife.
Yes.
And the prosecutor brings out the knife and this with a drum roll, and they find the man's DNA on the knife.
Yes.
And they say, you were there. And he says, well, it's a possibility somebody has matching DNA. And they say, no, it's 1 in a billion that they could have a 1 in 5 billion that somebody has the same DNA. And the jury is very swayed by this. Now, if I were the defense attorney, this is what I would get up and say. I would look at the jury and I would say, look, most of you are atheists, right? You all read the New York Times and you don't believe in anything designed. I said, so we know that the only reason why we believe we're here today is because there's a multiverse, an infinite number of universes with infinite number. So let's take that. That's why we're here. Now let's extend that. If there's an infinite number of universes with an infinite number of planet Earths, on those infinite number of planet Earths, there are infinite number of people who may have killed their wives. And in that infinite number of people who've killed their wives, there's going to be some huge number of people who are unlucky lottery ticket, and their DNA matches the 1 in 5 billion. If it's 1 with 100 zeros that we believe we're here today, well, 1 in 5 billion is certainly very likely, and there's millions of those types of people. So our defendant here is just one of those millions and millions of unlucky men in these universes who killed their wives whose DNA matches, and therefore I move to acquit.
Mm-hmm.
If you were the jury member, would you be moved by that argument?
No, of course I wouldn't, but I think that's a slightly bad analogy to the situation.
Okay, why?
I think we've got to accept we don't know. And I think my objection to most religious people is they say they can understand things and we can't. But the line I would take is that it's pretty hard for the average person to understand a single atom. I bet you couldn't write down a Schrodinger's equation for a hydrogen atom. And if we can't understand something as simple as an atom, how would we expect to be able to answer these deep questions about physical reality? We've got to accept the wonder and the mystery, interpret it as we like, but not be dogmatic about it at all.
Okay, but my only point was is that if I can accept my reality here today is because of multiverse, why can't I accept that the unlikely, and it's highly unlikely, why can't I accept that this fellow is also one of, just hit an unlucky lottery number, just like our universe did?
That's the kind of argument people might use. I don't know, but I think it's not a very good analogy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm. But I do think, seriously, we don't know if there's one Big Bang or many. I hope in 50 years we'll have a better idea. We may not, because our brains may not be up to it. And then we just have to accept the wonder and the mystery. And people may want to think that they know the answer. But I think the honest response to looking at the wonders of the complex universe we're in is to accept that it's something that we may, as tiny bits of it, not be able to understand fully.
So is it fair to say then, Doctor, that science, with all its great accomplishment, we still understand a tiny fraction of what there is to know about the universe?
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Dr. Professor, it's been a great honor to have you with us, and thank you very much for your time.
Okay, well, good to talk with you. Okay, but there's a wonder and mystery, and we're just starting to explain it.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Long way to go. Bye.
Honor of having with us on the phone Professor John Leslie, who's the author, really, of many books. The one that I read and I was fascinated by what is called Universes. He's an Oxford graduate professor for many, many years. Welcome, Professor Leslie.
Thank you.
So, Professor, and in your book, you write at length about the constant of fine-tuning of the universe. I'm sure most of our audience has never heard of it. Could you give us a few examples of what fine-tuning of the universe means?
Well, we're here talking about slight changes which we imagine to the universe, which would have made it a place where life would never have been able to evolve. And one of the slight changes which could be made would be to the early expansion rate of the universe as it comes out of the Big Bang, in which we believe the universe was created. Now, if you look backwards towards the Big Bang, things get hotter and hotter and hotter, and the calculations of the physicists get more and more vague because they're not sure what's going on. But what they are very sure is going on is that if you change the early expansion rate at a time when the temperature was 10 billion degrees by one part in a million, then you would have got a universe in which life would never have evolved. After that stage, if the expansion rate had been very slightly slower, the universe would very quickly have collapsed on itself because of the force of gravity. If the expansion rate had been very slightly faster, then everything would have flown to bits very quickly. We'd have a universe which was more or less what we call a very hard vacuum, hardly any matter in all the space. Now, if you allow yourself to get into speculative physics...
Doctor Leslie, I have a question for you. A part in a million million is how many? Like, try to explain me, what is one in a million million?
Well, suppose you're walking along and you're taking a stride of a meter long. After a kilometer, you've gone 1,000 meters. After 1,000 kilometers, you've gone 1,000,000 meters. If you go a million times that, that's a very far distance, very, very hard to imagine.
So is that 18 zeros?
That's 12 zeros.
12 zeros.
12 zeros. And in this field, you keep on getting across very great numbers, which are claimed to be numbers showing the accuracy with which some physical element of the universe has to be, as they put it, fine-tuned in order that life should be able to evolve. It's thought that what is driving the early expansion is something called dark energy. And this is associated with a number which Einstein put into his equations called the cosmological constant. And it's claimed that if you change that constant by one part in 100,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, rate.
How many zeros is that, Dr. Leslie?
It's 56 zeros after your one.
So it's 10 to the 56th power.
10 to the 56th power. Now, can I tell you how accurate that is with an example of trying to throw a dart to hit a target on the moon? You throw your dart, it hits the target, and it hits a target smaller than an atom.
It's trying to throw a dart from the Earth. You're saying it's like throwing a baseball, to use American analogy, but not getting it through the strike zone from 90 feet away from the mound, but throwing a baseball to the moon and hitting a target the size of an atom on the moon.
That's right. That's the sort of accuracy involved. And that's not the biggest figure you get in this field. I've seen figures of 10 to the power of 100.
For what would that be for?
That is for the balance between gravity, the force of gravity, and a force called the nuclear weak force. And it's suggested by Paul Davies, who's a very good physicist, that if you change that balance between those two forces by one part in 10 to the power of 100, that's one part in 10,000 trillion, 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 you would have had a disaster with space expanding or contracting at a disastrous rate. By comparison, the number of grains of sand on all the beaches of the world is only about 10 to the power 22.
That's, I'm sorry, 10 to the 22nd?
Yeah, 10,000 billion billion. That's much, much smaller than this number, which is claimed to be the sort of tuning which may be involved in getting the early Big Bang to expand at a rate which would allow later on galaxies to grow and stars to give rise to planets and life to evolve. And
so, Dr. Leslie, you've named so far. You've had the. You said you had the early expansion rate. You said if that would have been off by one part, 10 to the 12th, then you have the cosmological constant, which I guess keeps the current universe in limbo the way it is 10 to the 56th.
And you had there's also thought to have been what drove the expansion.
Okay, and then you have the balance of gravity to the weak force has to be 10 to the 100th power. How many other constants are there that are, besides these three, for the universe to be the way we know it, how many other constants are there?
Something like 17.
17 constants.
It seems maybe all of them have to be tuned to some degree, some more than others. For example, one of them is the degree of smoothness in the early universe. The early universe was a great deal more smooth than a billiard ball. And the biggest number I've come across here is a number calculated by Roger Penrose, who's a very expert mathematician and physicist at Oxford. And this is 10 raised to the power of 10, itself raised to the power of 1, 2, 3. This is 1 followed by 1,000 trillion, 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 trillion zeros. Penrose imagines God trying to place a pin into a large field showing different possible universes and trying to place this pin with enormous accuracy. And he has great difficulty illustrating this, but he's a very ingenious man. He shows God first getting the pin into a very small box, and then inside that very small box there's an even smaller box, much smaller, and inside that other small box there's another much, much smaller box, and God's pin hits the right place. Now, in fact, Penrose says he can't imagine God being that accurate. He'd much prefer a theory which simply said that the early cosmic smoothness was just a fact. We don't need to explain it. People worry about how to react to this sort of thing. One way of reacting is to say that there exist vast numbers of separate universes, and we live in one of them, which just happens to have all the numbers which were allocated at random, allocated by chance. All the randoms, all those numbers happen to come out right. And if they hadn't come out right, we wouldn't have evolved to see this universe. This is known as the multiverse explanation of the fine-tuning.
So, I understand that, just to explain what Professor Leslie's saying, is that there are 17 different, that we know of today, constants that if any of them changed, life would not be able to exist. For example, one of the constants is the balance of gravity to the weak force. The nuclear strong force, again, getting the nuclear strong force, I understand you write in your book, is a remarkably difficult constant to achieve as well. Electromagnetic vis-a-vis gravity had to be perfectly fine-tuned. So any one of these 17 forces distorted, and we would have had terrible things happen. The world would not be able to exist. And you're saying, Doctor, that the way scientists say, they say it's all by chance, but there's an infinite amount of universes, and we are the lucky universe. That's basically the argument, right?
Well, you might not have to bring in an infinite number of universes, just a very, very large number. And I must stress that this claim that all 17 of these numbers need to be tuned accurately is very controversial. And some people would say, oh, maybe you only have to tune 10 of them. Again, they're not all numbers of force strengths. The masses of various elementary particles are very important.
Give us an example.
Well, if the neutron were heavier than the proton by more than it is, or less heavy by more than it is, we wouldn't get a universe which had anything more than hydrogen, or else we get a universe of only neutron stars and black holes. Now, the difference between the neutron and the proton masses is one part in a thousand, and you have to be dealing with a very small change from that one part in a thousand. A very small change would cause disaster. Again, there's a particle which has recently had its mass measured, called the top quark, and if it was just very marginally heavier, we get a disaster where space at any moment might suddenly start to collapse, and this would cause a disaster because a small bubble would then expand at nearly the speed of light. It would destroy the Earth, it would destroy the Sun, it would go on destroying the rest of our galaxy, and it would keep on expanding outwards. That would be if this top quark weren't more or less just as heavy as it is. In the early Big Bang, there were a lot of particles called super heavy particles, and their masses have to be very carefully adjusted if we're going to get a universe which consists of a balance of light and matter. The threat there was that we get a universe in which there was practically no matter, just consisting of light, or else a universe in which there was so much matter that everywhere there were things called black holes, which places where the gravity gets maybe infinite, and you couldn't possibly get any life there. That's the sort of thing which is talked about.
Dr. Leslie, let me ask you a question. Those who believe that they're the only way to explain the incredible unlikeliness of our universe existing because of all these 17 things that are so finely tuned with so many zeros that when you combine them, it just becomes almost like an infinite amount of zeros, is that there are many, many universes and we're the lucky ones. How would they respond to the following question? Imagine that there's a trial and you're in the jury and a husband is accused of killing his wife. So they pull out the murder weapon and they say, you know, his DNA is on the murder weapon. The odds of somebody else's DNA matching this murder weapon is one in a billion. So most of the jury would usually vote to acquit, to guilty. They would all vote, look, it's one in a billion, one in 5 billion, he's the murderer, end of story. Now what happens if the defense attorney got up and he said, listen, we all believe that the reason why we're able to exist in this universe is because, you know, it's impossible. If you take the fine tuning, 1 with 100 zeros, 10 with 100 zeros after, 10 with 50 zeros, is there have to be multiverses, and since there's an infinite amount of universes, that's why this universe is here. Well, if there's an infinite amount of universes, on this infinite amount of universes, there's an infinite amount of planets just like Earth. On this infinite amount of planets just like Earth, there's an infinite amount of husbands who killed their wives. On this infinite amount of husband who kills these wives, there's going to be a large number whose DNA, 1 in 5 billion, got mixed up, matches somebody else's, and therefore I move to acquit our accused murderer. If you were in the jury, how would you respond to that?
Well, I would say that the argument which you've just given is on behalf of the defense, that's just hogwash, eyewash. It doesn't wash. And the reason is that even if you're against a background of infinities, you can think that some things are more likely than others locally. For example, look at the theory which many cosmologists like because it's very simple. that our universe just is infinitely large. That means that there's an infinite number of planets on which there puddles water. And it's a known fact that it's conceivable that a puddle of water would take heat from its equally cold surroundings and start boiling. This is because the direction in which heat flows is a statistical matter. It's almost always likely to flow from hot to cold, but sometimes it could flow from cold to hot on very, very rare occasions. Now, even if I think that the universe is infinitely large, I'm not going to expect the next puddle which I look at to start boiling. I have to assume that as far as the local probabilities are concerned, seeing a boiling puddle suddenly boiling because it's taking heat from its cold surroundings, that's just out of the question. Again, quantum fluctuations are able to topple a beer can standing on a level surface, but you'd have to wait a fantastically large number of years before you saw that happen. I'm not going to expect to see it happen tomorrow, and even if the universe is infinitely large, I won't expect to see it happening. I think that would be my sort of answer.
Well, Dr. Leslie, it's been a real honor, and I'm sure on behalf of our listeners of hearing such a prestigious author and professor, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. Bye then.
Thank you. I've never heard before. We've had, you know, one of the greatest scientists in the world, Sir Martin Rees. We had Sir John Leslie, Professor John Leslie. And what have they basically said? They said that the world, the universe's existence is a series of remarkably absurd mathematical unlikelihoods, and really that bends any reasonable person's, I think, beyond the reasonable doubt that these happened by accident without a design. Additionally, they both would agree that there is no credible answer 1,000 years later to Rabbi Nubachya Ibn Pakuda's question is, where did the bang come from? How does something come from nothing? Two great scientists. So when science boasts God is dead, I mean, after hearing Sir Martin Rees say, science only knows a tiny fraction of the knowledge that there is to know, and then say something, make derisional comments, I think it would be the equivalent of a grammar student, a child learning the ABC, come to school, and after he finishes the ABCs, look up at the entire BMG, Yeshiva, university, and say, you know, all knowledge here, based on my ABCs, is really, you know, backwards and extinct. When we hear one of the world's great scientists, they only understand a tiny fraction and can't explain these remarkable mathematical coincidences. Wishing you a wonderful week. This is David Lichtenstein. We will continue next week with different parts of this topic, beyond a reasonable doubt. Good night.